Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. We're going to talk today about strawberry compounds staving off organ damage, how living with pets is linked to a stronger social skills in children with autism, how keeping that good bacteria, the gut flora, in your system can prevent metabolic disorders, improve digestion, and strengthen your immune system. Before you take the flu shot, understand from Dr. Brownstein that it's not effective. What can save the world from a food crisis? According to the latest study, small-scale traditional organic farming. More on NAD, the cell rejuvenator. From our health and nutrition segment, our public health segment, we're going to also look at the government says this year's flu shot is a dud, but still won't allow any discussion of natural alternatives. Also today, from our fascism segment, from a professor at NYU, from the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm terrified of my new TV. Why am I scared to turn this thing on? And you'd be too, Michael Price. Time permitting, I want to explain in detail the problem I have with what I've mentioned many times, this growing private contractor epidemic in the United States that's being outsourced almost all the work at hundreds of billions of dollars, none of it accounted for, no oversight, from the J.P. Walter Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tulsa, the author of Modernizing Repression, Police Training in the National Building in the American Century, Professor Jeremy Kuzmarov. Also today, we will talk about something I've mentioned several times, that now the money in your bank account, your savings, your pensions, if it's in a bank, it's no longer your money. We'll have Professor Ellen Brown explain this in detail, the confiscation of bank deposits and the derivative debt. It is my belief that derivatives should be outlawed. We do not benefit from them. They are extremely risky gambles, and they're in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. So if those go bad, let's say Citigroup and J.P. Morgan, just two banks, if just two banks' derivatives go bad, there's not enough money in the United States to cover the losses. I'm talking about in the entire country. If you drained every penny out of every bank account in the United States, you couldn't cover the losses. If you took every dollar out of the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, you got about $25 billion, it won't cover it. We're talking about trillions of dollars in losses. And guess who gets off the hook? The banks. Guess who gets their savings accounts, pensions confiscated? The depositors. So we'll explore that in depth today. And we have a lot more depending upon time. Let's begin. We know that we should be eating a certain number of foods that allow for healthy bacteria to grow in our systems. We need good bacteria. We need it because of the bad bacteria. When you take an antibiotic, you destroy all the bacteria, but then the bad bacteria proliferates. When you eat sugar, you feed the bad bacteria. Alcohol, you feed the bad bacteria. Refined carbohydrates, again, a proliferation of bad bacteria, getting so bad that we also have yeast that proliferate, and it's called candida. Now researchers at Georgia State University have used improved technological approaches to further demonstrate the role that healthy gut flora, the bacteria's flora, plays in helping prevent metabolic disorder. And by the way, how big is metabolic disorder? Let's say about 115 million Americans suffer from metabolic disorder, overweight, diabetes, prediabetes. So it's big. So once you have healthy bacteria, it helps turn off inflammatory agents, but bad bacteria actually turn on inflammation, and that worsens it. So this research done at the Institute of Biomedical Sciences at Georgia State University found that you need the good bacteria. So where do you get good bacteria? Well, fermented foods, cabbage, like sauerkraut, that would be one good way to get it. Miso soup, that's another good way. So if it's fermented, it's going to get you some good bacteria. You can get it in non-dairy yogurts as well. Or you can simply take a capsule full of it. Now, I know those of you who are using green and red powders, you're getting about 8 billion good bacteria with every serving. That's terrific. A new research study from the Medical Research Council Mitochondrial Biological Unit in the United Kingdom found that strawberry, when it's dried, can help stave off organ damage. This is from the study. Quote, as a result of heart attack or stroke, blood supply to the body's organs can be disrupted, potentially causing serious organ injury. Researchers at the center have discovered that this damage is caused by a buildup of what is called succinate, a chemical that occurs naturally in the body when sugar and fat are broken down to release the energy stored in food, but abnormal accumulation of which occurs when blood flow to an organ is limited. When the blood flow returns, the excessive buildup of this succinate interacts with oxygen as the blood rushes into the oxygen-starved tissue. This causes the release of destructive molecules which react with muscle cells in the organ, damaging them. So then they found out that one way to stop this process, to ameliorate it, is with, quote, malonate esters are found naturally in fruits such as strawberries, apples, and grapes. The authors of study submit, quote, these findings reveal a new pathway for metabolic control of reactive oxygen species production in vivo, while demonstrating that inhibition of ischemic succinate accumulation and its oxidation after subsequent proliferation is a potential therapeutic target to decrease ischemic reperfusion injury in a range of pathologies, end quote. Now, this was published in Nature magazine. That's a big deal. So just in lay language, I realize that was very scientific, but I wanted to be accurate in quoting it. What are we talking about? When you do not have enough blood flowing to your brain, because you may have a carotid artery that's blocked, and most people do, or when you're not having adequate flow of blood to your kidneys, or to your liver, or to your heart, then you have a byproduct which builds up. And this accumulates, and then it can cause extreme destruction to the organ. So there is a substance to counter this buildup of this succinate, and it's called malonate, M-A-L-O-N-A-T-E, esters. Now, you find malonate in fruits. And so if you have the powder of the fruit, and that's what they did here, of grapes, apples, and strawberries, it helps prevent this, what they call reactive oxygen species, and that's simply oxidative stress. So it traps these, neutralizing them. So the takeaway message is, if we have not been living an ideal life, if we've eaten a lot of meat or hamburgers, processed foods, soft drinks, which most people have, it would really do your organs a lot of good if you started having, let's just say, make it easy. First, eat strawberries, grapes, and apples. But to get more power, juice them. And then you get a lot more of the benefit because you're you're getting a lot more of the actual healing nutrients. You're getting more of the malonate esters. And that's why juicing is so powerful. That's why it helps heal. The more juicing you do, the more polyphenols, chlorophyll, the more healing occurs. So that's the takeaway message. I remember being in Chicago and a major hotel, and I was filming the final scenes for The Drugging of Our Children. And there was a group of nearly 400 parents from around the United States who had come there with their children, and they all had a story to tell. And some of the people who came, the parents, were medical doctors. And some were significant medical doctors, and that one was a chairman of a department of medicine. And to a person, they all said that vaccines have been the principal contributory factor to their children's autism spectrum disorder. Remember, autism is not a single condition. It's a whole spectrum of conditions. They did not rule out other environmental factors, but the evidence to them was clear that the adjuvants like aluminum and mercury were neurotoxic. And they all had the same story. Their children were developing normally until they got a group of vaccines, and then they went into this dark place. Three things came out of that day. First, that they had all been using, or most were using, what was called the DAN protocols, which was a good protocol and certainly a good beginning step. And I interviewed, filmed many of the doctors using the DAN technique, and there were certainly improvements there. But today, on a scale of 1 to 100, I would place DAN at about a 10. We have so many more protocols that are so more advanced. But remember, even supposedly complementary doctors, or maybe orthodox doctors, but being more complementary when it comes to autism, take a long time to make changes. They don't just change on a dime. In any case, that was good that there was improvement. And for those who had taken it further, you even saw more improvement in their children. And what was also neat is they had all decided amongst themselves the kids to wear blazers. And so here you had the parents in the back and all the children in the front. And I took the camera and did a slow pan clear across the room. And then what really caught me, and the final statement was, the smallest kids in, then the next largest, and two, you had the oldest kids. I think it was about 17, the oldest. And when I just was about to turn off the camera, this last young man said, "I just want to make a statement." I said, "What is it?" He said, "I'm so grateful that my parents didn't give up on me." Wow. One of those statements that just hits you. And when you're behind the camera and you're directing it and you feel it, then you just know that the audience is going to feel it. And they did. I remember when it was first up on, and I didn't even know someone had put it up on Google. There was over, it was number one in Google in the whole world on a 24-hour period. And then Dr. Mercola put it up. It resonated with people. And a lot of school teachers started showing it in class. Because this is something we could prevent. Autism is not a genetic epidemic. That is a myth, completely lacking in science. But it is due to multifactorial causes, and at the top of that, causative factors would be vaccines. And I was thinking, gee whiz, what are you all doing? And one of the things that I've always suggested is get a pet. And get a pet. Adopt a pet if you're autistic, you have an autistic kid, because I've seen how a kid reacts with a pet in a way that they will not react with a human being when they have autism. And there is a bond that's created. It's as if the autistic kid invites the pet into their world. I've seen it time and again. And so I ask, do any of you have pets? And most of them have not, but one person stood forward and said, yes, we decided when we were out one day and we were walking, we walked by a store and there was a bunch of pets outside. And my son wanted up one of these pets, and now they're just inseparable. Here's the latest from the University of Missouri. And this was done at the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine Research Center, Human-Animal Interaction Project. Quote, a new study suggests that not only having pet dogs in the home, but also living with cats, rabbits, and other animals as pets may help children with autism improve their social skills. Previous studies show that pets encourage social interaction, and there have been reports of dogs helping children with autism develop their social skills. But before this new study from a researcher at the University of Missouri, nobody had shown this might also be true of other types of pets. Dr. Gretchen Carlisle, research fellow at the Institute, says that when pets are present in the home, the classroom, or other social settings, children tend to interact and talk to each other more. Quote, pet serves as social lubricants, she explains, noting that this increase in social interaction when pets are around also appears to be true of children with autism. This could account for the increased assertiveness she found in autistic children who had pets living at home. Kids with autism don't always readily engage with others, but if there's a pet in the home that the child is bonded with and a visitor starts asking about the pet, the child may be more open and likely to respond. And it goes on like that. I think pets are terrific. I do not believe in euthanizing them, as some popular, well-funded, exorbitantly funded, super-rich groups do. Someday there'll be a real expose when the media is not afraid to go after some of these groups. All you'd have to be is a human being visiting another soul in a hospice, and you'll see something phenomenal. When there's a cat present, watch how the cat goes to the person who is going to be most likely to die soonest and how they bond with that person and the interaction of the person who is about to pass with that cat. It's extremely heart-rendering, but it shows the affinity that that cat and the sensitivity that cat has to the spirit of the person. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen pets literally be the saving grace in a person's life, and how people can think of them as just disposable objects is just beyond me. But there's a whole lot out there who they want your cat and dogs, they can euthanize them. Well, and there's a whole lot more of us who believe that they're wrong, and that pets are extremely important in our lives. Researchers find a significant link to daily physical activity and vascular health. This is from the University of Missouri, and here's what it says. Quote, as millions of Americans resolve to live healthier lives, in 2015, research from the University of Missouri School of Medicine shows just how important diligent daily physical activity is. The researchers found that reducing daily physical activity for even a few days leads to decreases in the function of the inner lining of the blood vessels in the legs of young, healthy subjects, causing vascular dysfunction that can have prolonged effects. Wow. They're suggesting that, quote, professor of nutrition and exercise physiology also found the vascular dysfunction induced by 5 days of inactivity requires more than 1 day of returning to physical activity and taking at least 10,000 steps a day to improve. We know the negative consequences of not engaging in physical activity can be reversed. There is much data to indicate that at any stage of a disease and at any time in your life, you can get active and prolong benefit. However, we found that skipping just 5 days of physical activity causes damage to blood vessels in the legs that can take a prolonged period of time to repair. And of course, that can lead to, as they say, type 2 diabetes. One more reason, 5 days a week, an hour of aerobic activity can be very important. From Dr. Brownstein, quote, the title of the article, Another Ineffective and Toxic Flu Drug Approved by the FDA. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a new influenza drug. It's given intravenously at a single dose in adults who have been symptomatic with the flu for no more than 2 days. This drug is in the family of drugs, which includes Tamiflu and Relenza, which are oral medications. I've written extensively about the failures of oral flu medication. The inhibitors in the best studies have been found to be lessen the symptoms of flu for less than 24 hours. This new medication showed the same effect, and all the inhibitors are associated with very serious side effects, including nausea, vomiting, and headaches. Wait a second. I thought those symptoms were associated with the flu. Tamiflu has been associated with more serious side effects, such as psychiatric events and heart rhythm abnormalities. With side effects like those, perhaps a cup of soup is a better option. And yet, the U.S. government gave $235 million in grant money just to study this, and they could have put that money behind vitamin C and its impact on the flu. So that's just one person talking about the flu. But then there is this also. I thought this was important. Government says this year's flu shot is a dud, but still won't allow any discussion of natural alternatives. Quote, they're also telling doctors to supplement with drugs that don't work and have terrible side effects. This is the same government that wasted billions stockpiling these very drugs. The flu shot is not a static formation. It changes each year based upon the World Health Organization's assessment of which flu virus strains, usually 3 or 4, will be the most prevalent this season. The CDC is admitting that the flu shots distributed this year may not be a good match for the viruses currently in circulation. So, they missed it. So think about all the people who are going to get a flu shot thinking that it will protect them, and it won't. But all the danger that comes from that flu shot. And finally, what can help feed the poor around the world? Well, according to the latest study, small-scale traditional farming is the only way to avoid food crisis, UN researcher says. Quote from Nafis Ahmed, modern industrial agricultural methods can no longer feed the world due to the impacts of overlapping environmental and ecological crises linked to land, water, and resources availability. If we deal with small farmers, we solve hunger and we also deal with food production. The stark warning comes from the new United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food in the first public speech since being appointed by the UN. Quote, food policies which do not address the root cause of world hunger would be bound to fail. 1 billion people globally are hungry as of today. Before calling on governments to support a transition to agricultural democracy, which would empower rural small farmers, agriculture needs a new direction. And then it goes into how we need to go back to small organic farming. It uses less water, uses less land, has more abundant and variety of crops, more sustainable on all levels, and is healthier. So, all good. And from our environmental segment, this is from Tim Radford, Climate News Network, quote, deep concern over invisible threat to Antarctic glaciers. I'll quote this. The Antarctic ice shelf is under threat from a silent, invisible agency, and the rate of melting of glaciers has trebled in the last 2 decades. The ocean waters of the deep circumpolar current that swirl around the continent have been getting measurably warmer and nearer the ocean's surface over the last 40 years, and now they could be accelerating glacier flow by melting the ice from underneath. And a separate study reports that the melting of the West Antarctic glaciers are accelerating 300% faster over the last 21 years. Quote, calamitous consequences. If the West Antarctic ice sheet were to melt altogether, something that is not likely to happen this century, the world's sea levels would rise 4.8 meters. Yeah, well, that would drown everything near the ocean. Researchers from Germany, Britain, Japan, and the United States report in Science Journal that they based their research on long-term studies of seawater temperature and salinity sampled from the Antarctic continental shelf. This continued intrusion of warmer waters has accelerated the melting of glaciers in West Antarctica, and there is no indication the trend is likely to reverse. Okay, so in lay language, what does this mean? Let's go back to something I've been mentioning multiple times. We are now in chaos theory. So when they say that Antarctica is melting, that's largest amount of fresh water in the world is there, and Greenland is melting. If you were to go to Greenland in August and you were to walk on what had one time, let's say 30 years ago, been a pure 2 mile deep ice, as far as you could see, in fact, three times the size of Texas, you'd think this is completely solid. Go now. In that same area, you will find, as far as the eye can see, you'll find thousands of mini lakes. Some of the lakes are 2 feet deep, some are 8 foot deep, some are 10 feet deep, some are 2 miles across. That's the melting. Where does that water go? When it melts, it starts creating cracks. The cracks go down, and there are places where it looks like Niagara Falls. Just huge, billions upon hundreds of billions of gallons of water melting and going down, hitting the bottom, and then acting like a skid, skidding at a elevation, could be about 8%, and that's pulling the ice forward into the water. As a result, there's enormous calving underneath the ocean. Now, when we see a gigantic calving where ice sheet breaks, the largest being about, I think, 2 years ago, it was larger than all of Manhattan. It broke up and just went upside down and collapsed into the ocean, largest ever recorded in history. That's just the beginning. Now what is happening, they're breaking off underneath the ocean, so you can't see them. It's now heating underneath the ocean. There are geothermal springs underneath, and we didn't know that. So one day you could wake up and the water could be 2 feet, 5 feet higher. And for every foot that it gets higher, you're going to lose at least 100 feet inland or as much as 1,000 feet because of surging. So we're talking about a whole lot of trouble happening, and I believe it's going to come a lot sooner than later. I believe that most of this will start to show itself within the next 5 years. Because every single time they predicted something happening, they had been wrong. Every single time. They predicted that we could easily withstand a Category 1 hurricane. Well, Sandy was a Category 1, the mini-me, the little one, the least significant, the lowest on the totem pole. How'd that work out for everyone? Did you see anyone apologize? Did you see any of the meteorologists? Did you see any of the people who predict what could happen? Well, how about the people who were killed? How about the millions of people who were without power? How about the tens of thousands of people who lost their homes that still have not been rebuilt? That was a Category 1. That was as gentle as nature could impact us at a Category 1. Now, we're going to get a Category 3, 4, or 5. It's inevitable. What do you think they're going to say then? So I'm saying, since the experts are always wrong about everything, and when we're in chaos theory, why not just be prudent? And oh yeah, they missed this too. This is from Common Dreams. This is just in today. This was in the Washington Post. Quote, a monstrous cloud of accumulated methane, a potent greenhouse gas, is now hovering over a large portion of the western United States, according to satellite imagery analyzed by NASA. It is 2,500 square miles of methane plume created by years of intentionally releasing leaked natural gas during fossil fuel drilling operations, the cloud invisible to the human eye but captured by advanced satellite imaging technology, is centered over northwest New Mexico and described by the Post as, quote, a permanent Delaware-sized methane cloud so vast that scientists questioned their own data when they first studied it 3 years ago. So alarmed by the size of the plume were scientist NASA researcher Christian Frankenberger told the Washington Post, quote, we couldn't be sure that the signal was real. Though there is considerable less of it put into the atmosphere each year, methane is 20 times, that's 2,000% more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide or CO2. So what caused it? Well, hydraulic fracturing, drilling, fracking, and other intensive fossil fuel extraction operations. So that is a big deal. And yet, just now becoming aware of it. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. First and foremost, for our sister station, WBAI in New York, I did a three-hour fundraiser yesterday on relevant information, and we exceeded the needs of the station. We were able to raise enough to pay the payroll for the station for the next 2 weeks, so I thank all of you for helping in that effort. We're going to have a guest today from Hamburg, Germany, by Skype. My guest is Professor Gabriel Oettingen, and we're going to talk with Professor Oettingen about rethinking positive thinking, a closer look at the ways we approach and deal with optimism and positive wish-fulfilling thoughts. But before then, I'm going to go in a moment to Professor Ellen Brown in a short interview on the derivative debt and the confiscation of bank deposits, something the mainstream media has just not dealt with. And we want to go into this in some depth, and at least you'll get an idea of what this is about. And it's a good piece. And before we go there, I thought you'd find this interesting. This is from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, from Michael Price. Quote, I just bought a new TV. The only problem is that I'm now afraid to use it. You would be too if you read through the 46-page privacy policy. The amount of data this thing collects is staggering. It logs where, when, and how, and for how long you use the TV. It sets tracking cookies and beacons designed to detect, quote, when you have viewed particular content or particular email message. It records, quote, the apps you use, the website you visit, and how you interact with content. It also has a built-in camera with facial recognition. On the downside, the internet connection makes the whole TV vulnerable to hackers who have demonstrated the ability to take complete control of the machine. More troubling is the microphone. The TV boasts, quote, voice recognition feature that allows viewers to control the screen with voice commands, but the service comes with a rather ominous warning, quote, please be aware that if your spoken words include personal or other sensitive information, that information will be among the data captured and transmitted to a third party. end quote. Got that? Don't say ever anything that's personal or sensitive in front of the TV. It is listening and watching everything that you say and do. All right, well, here are my thoughts. Did you know that when you're buying it, does the person say, by the way, you're going to watch the television program you want, but it's watching you. And everything you do, if you should decide to have sex in the living room or the bedroom and your TV's in the bedroom, it's recording it. It's recording everything you're doing verbally and also video streaming it. And it's giving it to third parties, none of which is in your control. Oh, and when you turn the TV off, you don't turn off the recorder. You have to unplug it from the wall to do that, and most people never do that because they want the convenience of the immediate on-off. So, when you thought things weren't that bad, understand what's actually happening. Hey, but if you don't mind what they're doing, I guess you don't mind being videoed and recorded and that information shared with third parties so you don't know who they are, and there's nothing you can do about it. I'm Gary Noll. Now let's hear what Professor Ellen Brown has to say on global television about the banks taking your deposits, every nickel you have in the bank, if they lose money, and how they can confiscate yours.
Last month's G20 summit in Australia came and went without the protests and riots we've come to expect at the summit in recent years. But as author and researcher Ellen Brown notes, the real fireworks happened behind closed doors, where the group rubber-stamped new regulations that will make Cyprus-style bank bail-ins a worldwide reality. This is the GRTV feature interview with Ellen Brown and your host, James Corbett. All right, Ellen Brown, let's talk about a series of articles that you've been writing recently that I think are extremely important on the subject of banking regulation. And this, we can pick this story up at the recent G20 meeting, which really didn't create much of a splash in either the mainstream or the alternative media, generally speaking. But there was an important rubber stamping of a piece of, a white paper regulation proposal by a shadowy body known as the Financial Stability Board that very, very few people have ever heard of, but is quietly rewriting the architecture, the infrastructure for global banking regulations behind the scenes. And you start by noting this in an article that I'll refer readers to called New G20 Rules, Cyprus-Style Bail-Ins to Hit Depositors and Pensioners. And this is a very important subject, but one that unfortunately it's difficult for a lot of people to wrap their minds around because there's a lot of jargon here, including a white paper from the Financial Stability Board that we'll link to called The Adequacy of Loss-Absorbing Capacity of Global Systemically Important Banks in Resolution, which I defy you to say 10 times quickly in a row. But at any rate, these are the types of rules that are really going to have a significant effect on us. I'm sure the audience is by now very familiar with the idea of banking bailouts as what we saw in the 2008 crisis. But in the event of the next crisis, we may be looking at a bail-in scenario similar to what happened in Cyprus last year. For people who are not familiar with the idea of bail-in, perhaps you can walk us through that and what that actually means in the event of the next global systemic banking collapse?
Well, after the last one, governments balked at bailing out their big banks again. And so, for example, in the U.S., the Dodd-Frank Act said no more bailouts. Of course, they just now changed that, but that's what it said. And so but it didn't say that we're going to just let these banks go bankrupt. It said there's going to be a new way of doing it. You, the banks, are going to have to figure out how to recapitalize yourselves. And so we want to see you come up with living wills. These are like zombie banks coming up with living wills for what they're going to do in the event that they're about to expire. And what they're actually told to do is to confiscate the the assets of their creditors. And this would be their shareholders, their bondholders, and their depositors, which is the largest class of creditor of any bank. Now, theoretically, we're protected by depositor insurance. In the U.S., it would be FDIC insurance. But the FDIC fund, and that, first of all, that only goes up to $250,000. So the people who aren't covered would be businesses, for example, who keep a lot of money. They need a lot of money for their cash flow. They have to pay their payroll and so forth. And in Cyprus, for example, everybody over the deposit limit, which in the Eurozone is 100,000 euros, lost 60%, well, 50%, I guess, about in the end, they lost about 50% of what they had in the bank. Well, that was a huge hit. And these were mostly businesses, local businesses. So that means they wind up either closing their doors or laying off their employees. So everybody basically got hit. The whole economy got hit. And that's what we'd be looking at as well. I've seen that they're now telling their large depositors, pull your money out of the bank because we don't want it anymore. So now where are they going to go with their money? Of course, my thing is public banking. I think we have to set up our own publicly owned banks. So anyway, the people under $250,000, which would be most of us, are supposedly covered by this FDIC fund, which currently, last time I looked, had $46 billion in it. The problem is that there are $4.5 trillion or so of deposits that are covered by that $46 billion. That's like half of all the deposits, which are close to $10 trillion. So obviously, there's not enough money to cover all the deposits. Theoretically, the FDIC has a $500 billion credit line with the Treasury. But first of all, they have to pay that money back. They're supposed to give this a payment schedule and show how they're going to pay it back. Who's going to pay it back? It's supposed to be the their members who pay premiums. And the last time they had to pay back much, much less, just like a few billion. It was very hard on the small banks, and many of the small banks then wound up either going under or selling out to the larger banks. So they would never be able to bail out a JP Morgan or a Bank of America, which both have over $1 trillion in deposits. But the big liability is their derivatives. They have there are $280 trillion in derivatives that's the exposure of the US banks. There are six big banks that are there, or five or six big banks that are the big derivatives banks. And so JP Morgan, for example, both JP Morgan and Bank of America have over $50 trillion in derivatives. So if they get hit with a big derivatives loss, then it could well wipe out their deposits. And the problem is that under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, the derivatives players go first in bankruptcy. So they get to snatch all the collateral before the FDIC even gets in there, or the state and local governments, who they theoretically are secured with collateral, but so are the derivatives players, and they're the ones that get to go first. So they're going to take all the money. And right now, what we're looking at, and why I think there's all this haste to change the rules again, is the collapse in the price of oil, which has gone down by about 50, it's gone down by half, which nobody anticipated. And it's not within, of course, the banks plan for it, they hedge and they plan for all these things when they do their derivatives, but nobody planned for that because it simply was not the result of supply and demand. There's pretty good evidence that it's actually geopolitical warfare against Russia and Iran, but particularly Russia. So there are the big banks are the counterparties on all these derivatives that the oil producers buy in order to protect their price. It's just like derivatives. The original derivative was agriculture, where the corn producer would want to guarantee the price of his corn, and he didn't know what it would be several months ahead when the corn finally went to market. So he would lock in a price, and some speculator would take the other side of the bet and agree to pay that price no matter what it really was, betting that it would actually be more than that. So the banks are the counterparties on these oil bets, and they could go very, very wrong. I mean, they obviously already have gone very, very wrong, but there's a certain payout period, so they're not... Some of them must have been due by now, but most of them, I think, are like 3 months and several years ahead. So the oil price will have to go back up very quickly, or somebody's going to lose a lot of money on that. And it turns out now it's going to be us.
So there you have it. Did you know that based upon the new rules that were passed in the budget, that they could transfer your savings then into an investment in the bank, which means nothing for you. It just means the bank can then get full use of any money you have when it has a loss. Now, are we going to have a loss? Oh, you bet. This year, I believe, we're going to have massive corrections in the market, and they should outlaw all derivative tradings, but they won't. They should outlaw all tradings in commodities essential to life, water, oil, gas, food, but they won't. They just keep doubling down because there's so much money to be made. Now, they've managed to buy the politicians and to get the law passed that, as you heard them, they get their money first. And there's no money left. There's not enough money in the government to pay $50 trillion back to the banks. But they're obligated to do that. So just imagine the crisis that's going to come. It's not will it happen, it's just when. I'm Gary Noll. Let's now go over to Hamburg, Germany. We're standing by is Professor Gabriel Oettingen, O-E-T-T-I-N-G-E-N. And the professor is a professor of psychology at the University of Hamburg in Germany and New York University, where her research focuses upon how we think about the future and its impacts upon cognition, emotion, and behavior. And for the past 20 years, she's investigated the role positive thinking and optimism play in researching this and seeing, do goals and achievements actually succeed, the benefits and the shortcomings. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me from far away.
The history of positive thinking goes back a long way. There was the New Thought movement in the earlier 19th century in the United States and influenced people like Mary Baker Eddy and William James and other proponents of self-motivation. And today it's a common characteristic in numerous self-help and self-empowerment New Age modalities besides in behavioral psychological practice. And certainly in my own practice of counseling individuals, I observe the positive impact that positive thinking can have. I've seen people reduce high blood pressure. I've seen them become motivated to change unhealthy habits affecting their health or to become more physically active as a part of a healthy regime. However, and this is where it's important, under close scientific scrutiny and research, such as you've been conducting, there has been some fundamental shortcomings in the theory that simply fantasizing and hoping for a positive goal, that it will eventually happen. In other words, holding a strong visualization or intention is not sufficient to bring about the changes necessary or to reach a desired goal. So I'd like you to take your time and outline for us the basic cognitive and psychological principles behind positive thinking, then show us the viable means to bring positive change into our lives. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, think about your own resolutions. You probably thought about yesterday or in New Year's Eve. You have all these positive fantasies about what you are going to go and what you're going to achieve in 2015. And you have these dreams and these fantasies, and you have all the good intentions to actually reach and fulfill your resolutions. But then, as time goes on, things get hard and obstacles appear, and you might not be as successful as you thought. When you kind of, you know, hugged your relatives and friends on New Year's Eve. So why is that? And people had been thinking for a long time and wanted to believe for a long time that positive fantasies and positive dreaming and positive thinking about the future is enough to actually achieve your wishes and to fulfill your dreams. And, there was good reason to believe that, you know, positive thinking in general is a good thing. And you hear it from everywhere, that positive thinking, you just need to think positively, and then things come true, whether it is in your professional life or in your personal life or when it comes to fitness, and just think positive. And it depends. It depends on many things. So it depends in what way you think positively, and it depends what you do with your positive dreams cognitively, whether you can actually make these dreams come true or not. And what we found in our 20 years of research now, at the beginning of these 20 years, what we were kind of astounded ourselves, but what the data taught us is that the more positively you think and the more you have your dreams carry you away, the less successful you are over time. So it is not only that these positive dreams and fantasies do not help, but it also hurts to dream sort of positively and sheer positive thinking. That actually hurts you when you want to achieve your dreams. Though they are pleasant at the moment, it hurts you to actually realize, when you actually want to realize your positive dreams and fantasies. So, for example, overweight people who were enrolled in a weight reduction program, the more positively they thought about having success in that program, the less weight they lost over 3 months and over 1 year. Or the more positively university graduates thought about an easy transition into work life, the fewer dollars they earned 2 years later and the fewer job offers they got. Or the more positively students thought about excelling in an exam, the less well they actually did on the exam. And even in the personal area, so the more positively students fantasized about getting together with a person of the opposite sex, who to get together with that person in terms of a romantic way, the more positively they fantasized about that, the less likely they actually achieved success in getting together with that romantic partner. Or the more positively people who were enrolled in a hip replacement surgery, so the more positively they fantasized about the success in that surgery, the less well they recovered, as indicated by the physical therapists. So it seems that the more positively you daydream and fantasize about a desired future, the more pleasure you have right at the moment. Actually, that's what the data show. But the less successful you are in terms of putting in the necessary effort and in achieving the success. So, for example, when you have students who positively fantasize about the future in general, they feel good right now, but they get more depressed over time. And even on a more general level, the more positive newspaper reports about the economic developments are, the less well the economic developments in fact are. So it seems that the more positive the spirits are and the more positively the fantasies are, so pleasant at the moment, they have their costs in terms of long-term development of mental health and of physical health. And you know, to tell you the truth, at the beginning we were surprised too, because we thought, oh yeah, positive thinking is a good thing. It's a good thing in general, but it seems you need to be very careful for what you need positive fantasies. For feeling good at the moment, yeah, but for actually achieving success and for putting in the necessary effort when things get tough, you need to be more careful with these positive fantasies. And that's what we asked ourselves then, said, what can we do to these positive fantasies and daydreams to make them actually motivationally fruitful, to actually use them, to actually achieve these positive daydreams and fantasies? And that's where we came up with the idea, what you need to do is to supplement them with a clear sense of reality. So when people positively fantasize about fulfilling their wish, they can possibly fantasize and sort of understand where the direction of their doings lies. But then they need to supplement these positive fantasies with a clear sense of reality, with what stands in the way, what holds them back, what stops them in themselves from actually achieving these wishes. So I would, for example, ask you and say, you know, what is it in you that stops you from actually going for your wish, from actually trying to fulfill your dreams? And that's what we call mental contrasting, and that's what I'm kind of elaborating on, apart from many other things, but that's what I'm elaborating on in the book, Rethinking Positive Thinking Inside the New Science of Motivation. And we also have a website where you can get more information on that concept, what we call mental contrasting of the future with the reality. And the website is called whoopmylife.org. It's W-O-O-P. And I will, in a few moments, I will explain to you what whoop means. Mylife.org. Okay, sorry.
No, we're out of time, but you've given us both a very unique insight. From what I understand you're saying is that we can fantasize all we want and project our desires and ambitions, but we have to keep grounded in a very pragmatic and practical way and develop both the intellectual and the spiritual and motivational skills and discipline to see that it gets done in a manner that we don't lose focus upon what we have to do, what tools we need, how long it's going to take, realizing that there are going to be problems in all the things we want in life, and be preparing ourselves for these problems so when they occur, we're not just swept away and we don't end up going back to that pre-fantasy time and then just being depressed. And that's the message I have. Very good. Thank you very much, Professor Ottagen. The website is woopmylife.org.
And you find two apps on that website, too, where you can actually use that strategy, which we call WHOOP, in order to fulfill your wishes and solve your concerns.
And the book is Rethinking Positive Thinking Inside the New Science of Motivation. Much appreciate you being with us from Hamburg, Germany, Professor Gabriel Ottagen. I'm Gary Noll. That brings up the end of the program. Thank you all very much for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I've gotten a couple of emails here. We lost the original Mayor Cuomo yesterday or this morning, and people are asking this question, and they're saying, you know, we're coming up to elections next year, and people are touting Mayor Cuomo as someone who was a liberal but claimed to be a progressive, and people are asking, what's the difference between a liberal, a progressive, a conservative?
Well, they all have different basis of belief, and the problem is I don't believe we should really be casting ourselves into that position. A progressive is simply looking for the truth wherever it may be, rather than an ideology that supports a particular belief. So if I find that the government is not living within its mandate to be minimally intrusive in our life, to protect us as it should, to hold those accountable, responsible for their misdeeds, then that would align with some people with a more conservative or libertarian perspective. On the other hand, I believe that we should be supporting those who cannot at this time in their life support themselves, especially the oldest amongst the population and the youngest. We have 2.5 million homeless school children in the United States, and 18 million of them are hungry. We have over 12 million virtually at poverty's door senior citizens. A compassionate society goes out of its way to see that their needs are also maintained. We have to care about not indebting people. So each one of those positions will align with a different group. But if you keep away from the isms and you simply look at what is the truth that I need to live by in this moment to live a moral, ethical, and honorable, caring, and compassionate life, then you transcend the limitations of being monikered as a Democrat, a Republican, conservative, or liberal, because I can show you vestiges of conservatives through Lincoln, in part, and Jefferson, in part, that would rival and exceed any so-called liberal today. I can also show you that there's limitations to those individuals as well. So we have to look at the strength and weakness, the honesty. If we get to the point where we no longer are willing to do one of three things, lie to others, accept lies from others, or lie to ourselves, then the truth is right in front of us. Then that motivates us to make our next move. All right?
Okay.
Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Let's say hello now to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
It's the first Free Your Mind Friday for 2015, and listeners, as usual, will have their say.
Utrice, lead right now.